This is an oral history interview with Brian John Huntley. It's the 9th of March, and we're at his home in Betty's Bay. Thank you, John. Now, I will start off by tracing your own background. How did you become involved with Marion Island?
I was studying at the University of Natal in 1964, and I missed a lecture. But apparently during the lecture, Professor Bayer, who was my professor of botany, had read a letter to the botany students saying that Professor von Zinderen-Bucker was planning a trip to Marion Island, and they were looking for a botanist for it. So I wasn't there. At the end of the afternoon when I arrived at the, it was a practical. At the practical, one of the my friends there said, "Hey, Brian, you might be interested in this. Go and speak to Professor Bayer," which I did, and he gave me the details, and I wrote off to Professor von Zinderen-Bucker, and then on whatever day it was in September, I got a letter from von Zinderen-Bucker saying that this is what it's about, you know, would I be interested, the application. And I can't remember when exactly my participation was confirmed, but it was, you know, it was sort of about October or so. So I was actually in third year at university, so I decided, well, forget about honours for the moment, because I was going to go on to do honours, and Edward von Zinderen-Bucker, the son, came down to Pietermaritzburg for an ornithological conference, and we met and chatted, and then I went up to Bloemfontein soon after finishing the end-of-year exams, and visited there with von Zinderen-Bucker and the son for a day or two. Then we left on the 29th or so of December. But I remember when I was in Bloemfontein, I think it was when Verwoerd was, there was an attempt on his life. Was that in December or November? November 64 at the showgrounds. I might be confused using things. But I just remember the significant thing is we couldn't get a drink in the pub because there was some political reason when I was up there. Or it might have been because it was Bloemfontein.
From which port did you leave?
Cape Town. There we went, yeah. Came down. In my diary, if you read the diary, you know, the first several pages about the arrangements and the fact that the Department of Public Works, who was supposed to supply us with equipment, didn't have the equipment ready and clothing.
Took von Zinderen-Bucker's tent. He had
He had bought some tents. And we had tents and sleeping bags that he had bought, But otherwise, the PWD, I think it was PWD, or Department of Transport, not PWD. I think it was Department of Transport. Didn't have our equipment, you know, our clothing, our boots and our jackets and our etc.
Were they supposed to issue you with different clothes? They issued a team?
No, just the standard team stuff, but they didn't have it, and they didn't have the size, and they didn't. And the team also didn't have real field gear. They were more sort of. But as I say, you'll find all that detailed in my diary.
Diary as well. Where did von Zinderen-Bucker get the funding from?
He got it from CSIR. Von Zinderen-Bucker had. I can't remember when he actually came to South Africa from Holland. Probably in the 50s.
Yes.
And he had clearly established himself as quite a respected scientist. And he got a grant from CSIR, which at the time was 30,000 rand to cover all the costs of the expedition, other than the ship getting down there and other than, you know, accommodation and meals on there. So he got a grant of, pretty sure it was 30,000 rand for the whole two-year expedition.
I got the idea that von Zinderen-Bucker was also sometime a Dutch consul.
He was honorary consul for the Netherlands and Bloemfontein.
Did that mean he was politically well connected to actually get permission to send you guys to Marion?
No, I don't think. He was quite apolitical, and there's many anecdotes which I haven't included in my diary. But one of them was that one evening at dinner, we were sitting around dinner table, and something came up, and I could clearly sense that von Zinderen-Bucker was not comfortable with the South African government, or at least the Nazi sympathies of some parts of the government. And so he told us a long story about how during the war he had hid the bicycle of somebody I'm not sure whether it was a Jewish person, but it was somebody who was not in with the Nazis, and he had hidden this bicycle in the roof of their house. And he went on a little bit about, you know, basically saying, look, I was part of the resistance, without being, you know, saying I was in the resistance. He was sort of saying he was totally unsympathetic with the Nazis. And I thought, well, you know, this is sort of getting, we never talked politics around, but I think he was just wanting to make a statement to everybody that he wants to have nothing to do with, you know, that side of things. And so I don't think he had connections at all in South Africa from the point of view of being connected with the government. I think when Wilhelm Verwoerd, completely independent, applied to be in the team, Von Zinnenbacke was sort of, I suppose, a bit surprised. And this is a good scientist, prime minister. But in fact, I think he was completely happy with the decision because Wilhelm was a really good worker. I mean, he was completely, there was never any sort of kind of attitude from him that, you know, my father's the prime minister, I can do it. And in a way, he facilitated some arrangements just being on the expedition. But I think von Zinnenbacke's decision to appoint him as the geologist was completely independent. It was just he decided, well, he's a volcanologist, we need a volcanologist, he's the guy. Support for the expedition was purely on the basis that von Zinnenbacke was a paleontologist, a paleoscientist of international standing, and CSIR said, okay, this scientist, he's got a good proposal, let's support him.
At that stage, do you think they needed to get special permission to visit Marion Island, convincing the Department of Transport to take you guys down on the ship?
Yeah, I think so. It was, I mean, there was no sort of sense that there was any special arrangements made, other than that there had to be accommodation, which there was on the island, and the base at that time was a wonderful base, and it had, you know, it was really nicely designed, it had lots of space. It wasn't as though there was this massive sort of crush of people there that you seem to have today, where, you know, everybody's got to get their bookings made and whatnot. I think it was, the money was there from the CS on Zinnenbacke, got up and, you know, made the plans and did them.
So how did they prepare you guys for going down? Did you get to chat to people who were there?
I mean, this was one of the remarkable things that I now, you know, going back after 40 years or so and seeing the science base and the science programs, I realized how ill-prepared I was. I mean, to go to a place like that. And our equipment, simple compared to what's available now. In that, there's notes on my recent visit, you can see there, I mean, I sort of describe the differences, how things have changed. But, no, I remember I went and saw Professor Bayer, and I said, no, you know, I've pointed to this expedition. What advice can you give me? There were two bits of advice, one from him and one from another person. Bayer said, it was, it sort of amazed me at the time. He said, you know, you just need basic equipment, you know, you've got to go and just walk. But what comes in useful, you know, to have a pair of pliers and hammer and this and that and some blow throat and, you know, you never know. So this guy, as it turned out, I mean, I used bits of wire and, you know, handgemaakte goed that I did. Von Zinnenbacke had some very sophisticated equipment that we used, which we bought and I used. But in fact, it was the simple things that worked. The other advice that I was
given. You didn't have duct tape back then, did you?
But it was the same sort of thing. If you had duct tape, a big blow draught in the tongue, mark dinge reg, you know. I've spent many years, 30 years in the bush, and blow draught in the tongue has got me out of a lot of difficult situations. It was old John Poynton, who was a professor in zoology, said that I should take for reading Darwin's Voyage of Eagle. And unfortunately, I couldn't get a copy of it. So I didn't. And, you know, afterwards, I just thought, it would have been such a fantastic book to have there.
Have you read it then?
Yeah, subsequently. But, you know, I'd recommend to anybody, any young scientist going to the island, to read the Voyage journal. There are various editions, you know, but you can get various.
So what reading material did you take
there? I had quite a reasonable library of my own, appropriate sort of basic standard, you know, references. But, I mean, at that time, there wasn't a big literature on the subantarctic. In fact, there was very little.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I had a couple of papers of some of the earlier work on Macquarie and Garth Georgia, but it was very limited. Some books on the Scottish Highland vegetation and Norway, you know, the sort of more and the sort of northern Arctic sort of areas. But there was very little relevant literature or sub-Antarctic literature. I mean, there was none. There was nothing on Marion Island, for instance.
So how did you know about Marion Island before you applied for this expedition?
No, I had, in 1957, when I was at sort of high school, they had the International Geophysical Year, the IGY. I must have done a project at school, you know, just a little school project. And so I was aware, and you know, the Transantarctic expedition that Sir Vivian Fuchs was on. So I had I'd known of the Antarctic and that sort of thing. And so I suppose I had a little bit of a sense for, you know, there is this place, but no real knowledge of what it's about.
Who were the people involved in organizing the trip from South Africa's side? It was Van Zinden and Bakker.
And the Department of Transport at that time.
Can you remember who the contact person for the Department of Transport?
No, I had very little to do with those arrangements. I mean, I just basically arrived in Cape Town with my Bakhasi and I had two little boxes of books and things, and that's it.
Did you meet the expedition party before?
I had met Van Zinden and Bakker and Edward in Bloemfontein before, and then that was it. I mean, we met when we were in Cape Town as we boarded the ship.
And this was the RSA. How was the journey down?
It was okay, but most, you must, perhaps if you read just the first 10 pages of my diary, you'll see I give a description. But I mean, compared to the Agulhas, it was a much smaller, bouncier, definitely considerably less comfortable ship. But it was okay. We sort of, most of the folk were pretty sick.
Have I wasn't. Had maritime experience before that?
No, other than just sailing on the castle ship along the coast, you know.
On the castle, Union Castle.
Yeah.
So have you sailed on open sea?
That's a vague
idea of.
Very minor. Very little. You know, 5-day ship on a castle liner.
And do you think the others on the vessel had experience?
I think some of them, I think they might have had a, you know, the same similar sort of experience, but the fact was that 90% of them got totally sick, and some of them just never reappeared when we got to the island.
At that time, McNish already took over. Captain McNish.
He was the captain, and Funk was the first officer.
Did you have any interaction with him?
Yeah, I know, because we just sort of kind of had pretty free rein on the ship. We just went where we wanted to. It was a small ship, you know, it was much more close. There was the team when we went down, there was the Sinai team, because we went in December. So there were the Sinai members and then the expedition members.
The ship went past Marion, stopped into Sinai.
That's right,
Did the Sinai members also go on shore, Marion, for a little while?
One or two of them, they had this instrument called the tellurometer, which was for measuring the distance very, very accurately. It was a South African invention, and so they needed to measure a baseline between two points to fix the base, so you've got a measurement. And so there was a chap on the ship going to Antarctica that had a tellurometer. Name's probably in my diary. And then he and Otto Langenegger, who was the surveyor, and Wilhelm Verhoet went off to do that. But I think most of the Antarctic folk stayed on shore. Stayed on the ship.
In terms of what you did on the ship, did you spend time in countings or looking at
whales? Not counting. We were doing sort of just basically looking to see if they were whales. It was very interestingly, Edward, who was who was the ornithologist, was so sick he never sort of came upstairs. And what's his name? Old Neville Fuller, who was the marine biologist, he was even more sick. And I was the only sort of biologist that went up on deck most of the time on our way down. And I didn't know the seabirds at all. And so we didn't do any, you know, scientific measurements on our way down.
At that time, I'm making an assumption now, but it weren't exactly seen in the modern mind as they were now.
I remarked on this in my diary that we saw no whales, and that was, whereas in this trip that I went in November with and we saw a lot of, well, to begin with, we saw quite a few whales, and it was notable that we didn't see whales on our way down. We did see a whaling fleet come into between Marion and Prince Edward one night, which was probably, but that was much later, you know, while we were on the island, we've been there for many months.
Because whaling was not banned by that time.
No, but it was, I don't know if there was, that was in 64, had it not been banned yet?
Not in South Africa. Okay. We've undersigned the various treaties.
Okay. But I remarked on the fact that we saw no whales. whales there. We saw killer whales around the island, you know.
Yeah,
you see it,
but
it's not.
But interesting. So, but there was an awareness that whales are something to look out for.
Yeah, yeah. But sure. No, no. We you know, we were looking at the albatrosses and what else and seeing what.
If we can very shortly describe Nish.
McNish was, you know, quite a serious sort of, you know, you could see he was quite sort of. I remember when after being there for 15 months, when I went back onto the ship, he greeted me very warmly and, you know, let me sort of, you know, just gave me sort of a welcome and, you know, really friendly and but I found, you know, he was obviously quite a kind of serious guy. And I remarked on our New Year's Eve party on the ship going down that it was quite, not a, you know, it wasn't a wild party. It was quite an orderly sort of party. You read on the 31st of December about that. But what one incident that I remember well, when we were landing on Prince Edward Island and
on Prince Edward Island as well.
Yeah, in March of 65. We had these rubber inflatable rafts and we had just a small little boat with an outboard motor which would push it onto the coast. And it was all quite sort of tricky. And McNish was up on the deck and I was on the rubber raft, a couple of other people, and Funk was on the little outboard motorboat. And McNish was trying to tell Funk that he should go this way or that way or something.
Mm.
And Funk shouted up to him and he said, "I am the captain of this boat and you will shut up." And McNish, so he said, "Yes, sir." You know, because the rule is whoever, you know, when you're on the boat, it doesn't matter what, whoever's the senior person on the little, whatever size boat it is, he is the person that's in charge of the boat.
Okay.
And Funk, you know, just told him to shut up, George. Yeah, it's amazing. And Funk was quite a funny guy. He had lots of he was always swearing and everything was left word. But he was more of a character. I think Agnish was quite sort of serious about
it. It must have been interesting in that context of South Africa at that time to have somebody who speaks his language that much. And,
yeah.
You know, that almost impolite.
Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah.
Because the team, but they obviously warned before that you were coming, the team that was on Marin at the time.
I mean, they had, you know, several months, you know, knowledge that we were going to come.
What was welcome?
Very good, yeah. I mean, I described that too in detail. I mean, the officer in charge there, what is his name? Ludwig von Chucks. Anyway, you'll find he was a mathematician or physicist or something. You know, he was the head of the Mesh team.
Mm-hmm.
And they know they were a great group. They really made everything, you know, they did everything they could to help us and make us well, you know, let us get on with our work. Yeah, it was great. It was really, I mean, again, I keep on referring to my diary. I've been reading it because, you know, I made a lot of comments about how welcoming and considerate they were and also how disciplined they were.
Mm.
The base was kept spotlessly clean, people to their duties of cooking and, you know, cleaning up and everything. The team had a lot of respect for Ludwig.
Did they give you tips about the environment you had
to work in? Not much. Most of them hadn't been far from the base at all. But several of them joined us and helped us carrying equipment around and coming out in the field with us. The medical orderly, who was from the Army Medical Corps, Loki De Beer, he came on several trips with us and helped us carry extra packs and that sort of stuff.
So he was a medical orderly from the Army. Did he actually perform any surgery on anyone?
No, let me tell you a story about it. I asked Lawrence Loki, how was it he ended up on Marion House? So I said, Brian said, no, it was like this. He said he just had a disc.
Yeah.
He was actually the driver for the Surgeon General in the Army. The Surgeon General, whose name you will be able to find, I think it was a Jewish name. He was driving the Surgeon General to some function, and the Surgeon General said to him, you know, Loki, you're being very kind of depressed. What's the problem? And he said, well, you know, sir, I've had a divorce and it's, you know, I've got no money and it's very difficult and I just need to find somewhere of getting, you know, getting a better job. So he said, no, but there's this Marion Island that you can go down as the medical orderly.
Almost like the medical system.
So he went on and he was our medical orderly.
No, but he died or?
No, I think he
broke
only
something more.
He could give you some Bernardo.
So when the new team arrived, a new team arrived
in March, April.
And then you guys have already been on the island
for 3 months, and then
were you expected to tell the new team?
Not really. They, some of them had been on the islands or on Antarctica before, so you know there was sufficient. There were some young chaps, Fred Clemens, who else was young? There were a couple of the younger, you know, Fred was not my age. I was the youngest there. But no, they more or less just sort of learned the ropes. I think the team leader of Ben Siokati, he had been Gough before.
Mm.
Most of the, you know, the older guys had been on some one or other of the bases.
Is it they who bought the parrot?
I think Ben Siokati brought the parrot, the green parrot.
The green parrot.
Yeah. It's an Amazon green,
Good freaky sort.
No, she could, which is disappointing to us. We tried to teach the parrot some flukle, but they never learned to speak.
And other kinds of animals?
We had Obas, the dog was there.
Obas, the dog.
But he was already there, and he left in 65 in March.
Van Zandbakken
took him back, yeah.
New chickens that they bring.
Yeah, they came, chickens and sheep and
chickens
things like
and
that.
Sheep.
Although they didn't bring more when in we took chickens and sheep.
You took sheep in December.
In December, yeah. They didn't send any more in March, April.
Okay. Did the sheep breed at all on the island?
No, they were hummels. Do you call them hummels?
Yeah.
Or what?
And the chickens?
Yeah, they laid eggs, some of them. But we had eggs, lots of eggs in a kind of a gel. So I can't remember how they... Yeah,
like
something,
gel,
yeah. We had plenty of eggs, lots of eggs, but we just ate it.
Oh, okay.
For eating. Might have done a bit of egg laying, but not much.
But they were never little
babies,
mini chicks.
No.
And the chickens, were they at all night?
Oh, yeah, we ate lots of them, yeah.
So if you ate lots of them, it must have been a lot of chickens.
We had, we'd have it as a, I mean, it was interesting. I would do a roast leg of lamb every Sunday, at least, or two legs. And I ended up doing a lot of, you know, we sort of the sheep, and I seemed to do quite a few of the lamb legs. And then like for a birthday or something like that, we'd slaughter half a dozen chicks or something. There were quite a lot. So they didn't last. I don't remember how long into the year they lasted. Because we had no freezers, you know.
Yeah,
we didn't have any frozen food. So we had potatoes and onions and apples last quite a long time. Cheese had quite a while. No, quite a few months. But then it was just dry rations. You know,
bully
yeah.
Tuna?
Not us. I don't think so. No, we didn't. I don't think we had. I don't think so. We might have had things like canned sardines or something like that, you know, but I don't remember.
Other species you might have brought from South Africa, did you try to plant tomatoes?
No, they had done that previously, but I think we, at that stage, we were deciding that we shouldn't bring in any alien, you know, non-Marian plants or soil.
So that stage really?
Yeah. It was probably at that stage that it was decided that there should be no more introduction. Van Zandbakken was quite sort of strong on that.
Did you try to eat any of the stuff on the island?
Yes, we experimented with kugel and cabbage and mayonnaise, and it wasn't so good. And eggs, you know, macaroni eggs.
I heard that the penguin eggs are
delicious. Yeah, it was more like a lobster, actually, more like a deer, which it was quite nice. But I just, you know, we didn't really get into eating it. We weren't very experimental, I suppose, in terms of... Yeah, and no, there was nothing else that we tried to eat.
Did you have guns on those?
I think there was, because they had a 303. They were trying to shoot a killer whale.
Why would they want to do that?
Because they were just bored. They even made a big kind of harpoon to try and harpoon a killer whale.
What was the plans to do with that?
I have no idea. You know, they'd go and take shots at killer whales or three. So there was a... I don't know why they had 303 on the island and whose it was. I think it was in the island, you know, the head of the officer in charge had a rifle for what purpose, I don't know.
In terms of the skuas, I know some previous teams were warned about skuas.
Oh yeah, we were too. And at first I didn't believe that they would attack, but we soon found out in the territorial they do come and dive bomb you. Have you been there during the breeding season, when they've got chicks on the nest, they do dive bomb you. And you know, most of us got sort of a couple once or twice.
So you went ashore with dinghies all the time and got her
and then they had the landing stage. You know, they had sort of they'd lower this landing stage down so to you'd have to sort of jump off the rubber inflatable raft. But then the equipment equipment was pulled up on a crane. They had a crane that came over.
And how did you go about your work? I mean, did you have a set plan beforehand? What was your specific...
Well, I was to do the vegetation map of the... not the vegetation map, but description of the vegetation and the plants and the survey of the plants and collecting, you know, all the species. So I suppose within the first, you know, week or two, we started working out a plan of operation. But I was pretty well... Zinner and Bucker more or less let me get on with things. I had done some botanical survey before that. I'd had experience in botanical survey. And so I just got on with the job and we just sort of worked on my car just non-stop for 15 months, you know. So it wasn't like Saturdays and Sundays off. Just worked whenever there was good weather, we were in the field. And if the weather was really too bad to go out, which was quite a lot of time. I mean, then we'd do work in the laboratory. I had a lot of laboratory work to do, so it was back and forth.
When you went out, how long did you go out? Most of the
usually
time,
not more than about 3 or 4 days, sometimes 5 days. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't carry, you see, there were no huts, there was no, we had to carry our tents, our food, everything we had to carry with us. So we'd have packs of about up to 70 pounds, and that would be about 30 kilos or so. And so going across the mires, the swamps, and that was quite difficult. And we didn't have cars, so, you know, we had to find places to camp. It wasn't a case of there being fixed routes or fixed camps.
Can you remember finding out that you can sink in a mine?
Oh yeah, no, we all sank in quite regularly. Yeah. It eventually kind of gets the feel, but it was wetter and much more boggy at that stage than it is today.
So you would say that later?
Yeah, in that little report I kind of make commentary on that. You see, I suggest that it might not necessarily be, because it might be two things. One is that they're better known paths, and secondly, you're carrying much lighter loads than we carry. And so, you know, if you carry a heavy load, then you easily sink in. But if you just sort of... today, they just carry quite small loads and they can cross the bogs.
Did you know you will have to be that fit?
Well...
Or did you get fit?
I got fit. Yeah, you get island fit, yeah. You become very fit because you're walking virtually every second day. I used to go out Junior's Corps 2 or 3 times a week. So I had a weather station on the top of...
Wow.
And I'd have to go up there and down every early in the morning.
And when you did get into base... And you did have like a couple of hours of free time.
Yeah.
What did you do?
Well, we'd either play snooker or read, listen to music, play darts. There was a few things. And then we had reel-to-reel films that we had. We had 12 films. We had no videos. So we had 12 films for the year. So some of those we saw a lot of times. Some would be broken. So, but we enjoyed, you know, on Saturday.
Did you have a midwinter party at that
time? Yeah, we had. But it wasn't sort of as sort of a bigger thing as there was on the Antarctica. We had a party. Yeah, we'd have quite a few parties. Yeah, on people's birthdays and that.
And your communication with Sana and Gough, did you have any communication?
Very little.
Did you guys get the same amount of telegram time or telex time?
We had I think it was 200 words a month, I think that was.
But it was the same as for the team?
Yeah.
And
then we had additionally once a month a call to von Zinner and Bucker, because of course he was there for the 3 months and then for the rest of the year. For the other 12 months, we had once a month this sort of talk, just to talk about the work.
Would you always just talk about work, or did they sometimes give you news from South Africa?
Not that much. We'd listen, I don't remember, we didn't have reception, radio reception. No, we didn't have the radio.
And later, so how did you get news from South Africa in general?
We must have had radio. We must have had some radio, because I remember when it was the Rhodesian UDI, we heard about that and we discussed it a lot. But I don't sure. Funny thing, I can't remember. Because we had a radio set up for one show. It had what they called at the time a single sideband, which is the ham radio, the amateur radio. And so I spoke with my folks on my 21st birthday using the ham radio.
So you celebrated your 21st birthday on the island?
Yeah.
Did they do something special for you tonight?
Yeah, we had quite a good party. Yeah.
Quite a good party. Did they make a gift?
I guess there must have been some. I don't really remember too much about that. Yeah.
You mentioned that you discussed the UDI. What things did you discuss? I mean, what if you had conversations? Was there something that particularly came up a lot?
We used to talk a lot, quite a lot, and even use the slang of the various movies we watched. And we avoided politics and religion. But it was quite a lot of joking and and our sort of internal language, that little expressions coming out of the movies we watch.
Yeah, sort of private jokes.
Yeah, around that.
And women, did you speak about women at all?
Not really. We used to. There was on one occasion we had one chap, Al Sadi Cronier, who was a hell of a nice guy, but a little bit sort of slow. And we told him that, you know, it was true that if you went and kissed one of the Lucille cows, she could turn into a princess or something.
Oh,
so
no.
we made this big story about that, which we tried to convince him. But no, I don't think there was too much talking about them. There were no.
Did you have like pictures from magazines and stuff like
in
that?
In the radio shack, there were some, you know, sort of Playboy images, but otherwise, can you imagine? Yeah.
Okay, if possible, can you describe a little bit of your interaction with animals on the island? The animals being a lot tamer.
Yeah.
Than you
well,
used to.
I'm not sure whether they are less tame, but they're extremely tame. I mean, you just will walk amongst the penguins. And
I don't think tame is the right word to use.
Mm-hmm.
More think less, not probably evolutionary, used to humans, or scared of humans as much. As
Think most of them were completely ignorant of humans, you know, so that you know, walking amongst the penguins, and especially on the more remote parts of the island, which is everywhere more than about a kilometre from the base, they were very kind of, I suppose, a bit puzzled by this other sort of penguin coming through, and they sort of kind of as though you were another penguin or trying to chase you. No, they were extremely unfazed by humans, really.
So was it sometimes not something that you would try to make some of them in pets or tea?
Oh, we had a paddy, you know, that sheath bull.
Yeah.
We had a tame sheath bull that had been a chick abandoned. I don't know what happened, but I brought it in. We had him in the kitchen, and I remember they started objecting when this paddy used to go and have a bath in the basin and the dish basin.
Did the paddy have a name?
I don't know what we called him.
Was it called?
It must be.
Were they called paddies back then?
Sheath bulls were called paddies. And I think he actually ended up in the Bloemfontein Zoo, because we brought back penguins and seals and stuff for the zoos.
Did you have to catch them yourself?
No, well, on the one, I sent a zookeeper from the National Zoo to Marion. I think both reliefs in the 85 and the 65, and what was it, 65 and 66, they caught a lot. I'd forgotten that, but I'd describe how many it was. It's a lot of them.
Who helped catching?
Just some of the boat crew and some of us, you know, it's just so we wasn't involved in other stuff that had,
The boat crew, speaking about which, were they coloured or white?
They're mostly coloured.
They also all came ashore.
Well, only in so far as they had to help of offloading. But most of the offloading on the island was done by the team. They didn't have any people off the ship. The people that were on the ship's crew only helped with ship's things.
Well, did you have any interaction with them on the ship's crew?
Not much, you know. I remember there was one stabbing or something like that. But I mean,
stabbing while you were on the ship.
Yeah, of one of between.
Thinking about the stabbing.
The ship's crew. Yeah. No, it was. I was just.
But it was more like kind of a rumor amongst you guys.
No,
probably happened.
It happened, but you know, it didn't.
Nobody got killed.
No, we didn't have anything like
that. Were they allowed to drink? The ship's crew.
I don't know. I doubt it.
And were you guys allowed to drink on the ship?
We must have been. I mean, we bought a lot of. We could buy. As it is today. In fact, it was much. Of course, much cheaper. And in fact. Buying whiskey was like £3 for a bottle of whiskey. And it was extremely cheap, on the ship.
Did you also have a bar kind of canteen on the ship?
Yeah, I think, I can't remember how it worked, but, there wasn't, we had a supply of beer and wine and whiskey, hot tack on the island, that we got every team member got so many bottles of whiskey, and for the year, so.
And who was in charge of seeing that those things are rationed?
Well, the officer in charge was really, the Met, the guy in charge of the Met station was really.
In terms back to your field work and the interaction of animals and so on, what impact did the Marion specific environment have on your research, if any?
Well, I mean, major in terms of just the weather. It was just so difficult to do field work a lot of the time, and the distances to carry your everything to the other side of the island or up to the top, over the top. It was much more time much more time was spent on just survival and getting places than spent on actually doing field work. So that was different. Now you can, you know, walk down to Kildalki and start working and come back and you've got a dry bed and everything.
Yeah.
And you work from, you know, sunrise to sunset. You don't, you've got nothing else to worry about.
Yeah.
Whereas we spent a lot of the time just carrying our equipment into the field and going there and having a tent blown down, or, you know, not having sufficient food for, you know, staying on there, things like that. Yeah.
And in terms of radio communication with base, did you guys take radios along?
We had a radio, but it didn't work, so we came.
Yeah.
It was a huge thing. It cost, it weighed 30 pounds. It was a big, awkward,
so
horrible
thing.
So you
rather left it at base after
we
a while.
Just, we took it on the first trip around the island. And it's, after the first, you know, day, it wasn't operational. It was only line of sight. So
oh,
it was
most of the time not going to be helpful at all.
Yeah.
And when you went around the island, were there still some of the sealers outstanding that you could actually stay in them?
No, they were there and they had stuff in them, but they just were dilapidated and wet and smelly, and, you know, the seals or the penguins had taken occupation of them.
So could you take any, did you take any of the things out of that to the base? Or?
No, I think one of the guys, it might have been old Loki the Beer, he took a rifle. There was a rifle, but I'm not even sure what happened to it eventually. But otherwise, no, there were some pots and pans and bottles and things, but we didn't really collect them.
You realize that those things were once used by sealers? I mean,
Yeah, we knew that, sure. Yeah. No, we knew. You know, old marshes, no pathway here. We had already,
I had read that.
Yeah, so we knew. He had given quite a, you know, good account of things, so we knew of the history of the place.
And the Solfant, could you still see a lot
Oh, you could still see, not much of it, but you could see it.
And there's a little settlement that built there where there's still some walls standing?
I don't remember that at Ship's Cove. It was down at Sealer's Cave and a couple of the places I described.
Why did you do laboratory work on the island itself?
Well, all sorts of analyses of the plant material I was collecting plankton from the lakes and pH and, you know, conductivity of the water and quite a range of measurements which would be seem to be extremely simple today, but the equipment that we had was sort of simple. So you know, quite a range of and microclimate readings of the temperature at different levels in different places, and, you know, within azurite cushions and outside, and, you know, all sorts.
Bring any lab work back home?
Soils and soils for analysis and some plant material. But most of the stuff that I did when I got back home was, other than the soils, was really just writing up there.
Did you realize by that time that you will do your master's on this?
Yeah, I think the intention was that I, you know, write up for a master's, and yeah.
Who was your supervisor?
I didn't really have a supervisor. I wrote it up, and when it was finished, I handed in stupidly to the University of Pretoria, because they wouldn't allow me to use it for a PhD, whereas in Natal, they said I could have used it for a PhD.
Did you do a PhD later?
No, I didn't. I started, and then I went to Angola and never wrote it. It was strange. I mean, I'd say von Zinnenbacher was essentially a supervisor, although he wasn't really. We differed in our sort of approach to vegetation survey. He was using a European approach, and I was using more a sort of American, Australian, South African approach. So we agreed to differ on our. Not that he, you know, he wanted me to do it in a particular way, and I didn't sort of see that as the way to do it.
What was the major difference between
The European, they call it, it's called the Brown Blanquet approach, but what they do, you see, they look at a piece of felt. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, in this area we'll list all the species and we'll say whether they're this or that, you know, abundant or whatever it is, but then select certain species in that which are, they call indicator species or constant species, and they've got a number of terms, which is fine when you've got quite a lot of species to work with. But on Marion there are only 23 or 4 species, and so it's not the species that's important, but how well that species is doing. So that individual species you'll find the island, but it's in how you differentiate communities or association or groupings of plants. It's more about the relative performance or health or vitality of the plant in a site than about what species it is or what grouping of species. So there's, you know, it was a technically and philosophically different approach. And the approach that he wanted to use, you could use if you knew the names of all the mosses, but we had no names for the mosses. It was impractical for me. Later on, about 10 years later, a Hollander, he came on, and because they had all the, by that time, all the mosses that I'd collected identified, and he also came from that school of approach, he could do a phytosociological account. And they use all these funny terms in it, which are very difficult for non phytosociologists to understand, but it was, you know, it was a good account. He did a great job, but one could do it if one knew all these sort of mosses. And
did you get the opportunity to describe the moss yourself?
No, I didn't do any descriptions of the, you know, not of the species. I described the vegetation, but not species. No, that's a, you know,
different.
Yeah, in fact, we didn't find any species which are new to science on the island. Not, I mean, of the flowering plants. Of mosses and lichens, they found a few that were not previously described. But the plants that I was working with were, I found about 5 species that hadn't been known from Marion Island before, but not new to science there.
In that process of you doing the biological survey, I understand that one of the goals was also to do a general geological survey of the island, and that involved naming. Did you all...
You mean the survey of the island?
Yeah.
I mean, that was Otto Longenegger that did that with the...
Sometimes ask your input in terms of names?
Not really. Sometimes we discuss things a little bit. But no, it was really mainly just for what that, that did the naming of the different copies and whatnot. Yeah.
Well, there's something Otto, named after you.
Yes, there's a Brian copy. It's yeah. And there was...
did you go visit it when you go...
I actually didn't go on to, it's funny, I never actually climbed it. It's on the west coast, so northwest coast.
Oh, yeah.
And I went past below it a couple of times, but in fact I only knew that that was the one that was named when the map came out, you know.
At that time, what ideas was there around conservation?
I think, you know, we were all kind of, those in the scientific team were very conscious about the importance of it as a nature reserve, but there was a fairly relaxed attitude from the med staff and what, you know, like they were shooting at elephants, at killer whales, and there was no proper management of waste management. It would just go into the sea and, you know, float around the coast, and the waste management was pretty relaxed.
Is it something you see in retrospect, or that you notice while you were there?
I noticed there, but, you know, it was, I did comment on it, but it was, you know, what are you going to do with all this stuff, that all the coarse cassis and everything, they just get, if you didn't use them to make a brine, you know, you'd just throw them in the sea. There was no environmental management policy, really. It was, you know, it was just a case of people not killing birds and animals, but otherwise it wasn't. And the thing is, people didn't move away from the base. They were just around the base, so, you know, so there wasn't really a worry that it would...
So there were no rules that you had to abide to in terms of environment?
No, I'm sure if we looked at the various documents of the time, it would say, you know, this is regarded in nature reserve, and you've got to kind of, you know, treat it as such. But there weren't any. I mean, now they've got so many kind of documents and management plans, and, you know, all that stuff. No, there was nothing like that.
When you were there doing the surveying work, etc., did you ever get lost?
Well, in the very first trip around the island, one of the guys got lost, but only for a night. And then the next day, fortunately, we were just about finished going around the island at Repetto Hill. Before Repetto Hill, it was Arzurelokop. It was misty and clouded, and he wasn't keeping up with us, but he was determined to keep up. And then when we stopped on one occasion, he continued, and we didn't know that he was ahead of us. And then, but the next day, he was up at about Pew Crags, I think it's called Pew Crags now. And we had sort of lost track of him, but he looked back and he saw the base camp and he got back to the base camp. So,
Were there at any time a notion that the environment is dangerous?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, we all, you know, were cautious on the cliffs and, you know, it was just a sort of natural reaction to the place, yeah.
But you wouldn't say you had an idea that this is the most dangerous place you've ever been?
No, I don't know. Well, I don't think so. I mean, it wasn't as though we were nervous. We just, we had none of this stuff about signing in and signing out. We'd go off and, you know, Eddie and I were just by ourselves there, so we'd go off and go for, you know, we'd usually say, well, we expect to be back in 3 days or 5 days or whatever. But there's no way of...
Just tell people when you'll be back. And challenges in terms of the working environment on Marion Island?
Well, the main thing was the cold and the wet and the wind and the rain, and getting your hands, you know, we didn't have good rain gear. We, you know, there's no Gore-Tex, there's nothing like that. So we had sort of plastic rain clothes which would get torn. And then also, I remember the thing that I felt most sort of uncomfortable with was, you know, cracked hands and all that, sort of never healing all the cracks and scratches, you know.
So you had a lot of problems with gloves and gear.
Yeah. Initially we had leather boots, just ordinary sort of high-ankled leather boots that were totally useless because they'd just get wet and the leather would break up, you know, just... And then we found that there were gumboots on the island for the PWD crew, I suppose. And we then we ordered gumboots. So in April of 1965, we got gumboots. And that's what we... But we didn't have decent socks, and we didn't have decent rain clothes. And we had these Norwegian jerseys, which were very heavy, and not really that, you know, woolen, heavy woolen. So we didn't have Gore-Tex or all this fancy gear that the folk now have, you know.
But, I mean, that technology wasn't really invented.
No,
Do you think that people, say, for instance, ever entering a place like a Galen or Macquarie got different gear than...
I think it was the standard. We didn't have any of these things like digital cameras or internet or computers or, you know, laptops or GPSs or any, you know, all of this stuff.
How did you navigate? Because his compass on Marion isn't always easy with rocks around.
Yeah, so we really just walked until we came to something.
Did you get any training beforehand in navigation
or
nothing. Any of these kinds?
Absolutely nothing.
But did you know something about it before?
No, I'd done a lot of sort of hiking in the Drakensberg and in Zululand and in the various game reserves, and so I'd done a lot of I'd done a lot of exploration up in the Sangoya Forest in Zululand. So I'd done a lot of living and camping and walking by myself.
This was just in your undergrad here.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Did you do a lot of field work in your undergrad here?
Yeah, all over Zululand.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Was there anyone with you who did not know anything about navigation at all?
Well, we had no navigation training, so it was just a case of just walking, you know, just...
What would you say was something that you particularly enjoyed about it here on Marion?
Oh, just everything. I mean, everything is just fantastic.
But
particularly the beauty of the place and the, you know, and the phenomenon of all these animals, you know, that were so tame and completely new, you know, working in a tundra, sort of tundra environment. It was just fantastic. It was just such a totally unusual experience because, you know, growing up in Zululand and Natal, you know, it was just so different. It was...
Did you have a cold winter, Aaron?
Well, it was cold, but it was, I mean, you know, the winters there go, down around 2 degrees, sort of 3 degrees. I mean, it's cold, but it was only bitterly cold up on the top of the mountain in the winter, in the snow, and in the snow, and but if there was a wind in the snow, and in the, you know, just getting wet and the cold driving through you.
Did you at all play in the snow?
Not much, because it didn't really snow that much down on the low, you know, around the base. In winter there would be snow, but, you know, and we'd build a snowman and that sort of thing. But no, there wasn't that much snow down. There's still, you know, there's even less now. But up in the top, there'd be quite a bit of snow.
Because I think 2 years ago, was it last year during takeover, not the short construction voyage, there was a lot of snow down at the base, but it was very warm in terms of previous years.
Yeah. No, look, it wasn't particularly cold here.
When you had to leave, you obviously knew that the ship will be coming at some other month, the week and the day. Was there anything you had to prepare to finish? Can you remember specifically saying goodbye to people or the island itself?
Well, the thing is that we knew more or less when the ship was coming, but it kept on changing the dates. So in my diary, I sort of described sort of some of the, not for me, I was happy to stay longer. But the Met guys were counting, oh, Charlie van Riet, you know, he was kind of like in the army, you know, Mindar, you know, he was counting how many days
that were left.
Yeah, sort of thing. No, I don't think so. If anything, divorced, I guess. I don't remember that he had.
Okay,
but the thing was that when we left, when the ship came down for the relief, for the takeover, we went to Prince Edward. So we sort of kind of half left at Marion, and then went to Prince Edward for about 4 or 5 days, and then left more or less from Prince Edward off, you know. So we didn't really have that much of a sort of farewell thing, because it was all over the place, you know. We're never quite sure when we're going, and then the ship comes, and we didn't know, well, oh, are we leaving today, or yeah, no, jump on the ship. So it was a bit sort of, it wasn't...
probably one of those hurry-up and wait sessions.
Exactly.
When you came back to South Africa, what was it like first couple of weeks in South Africa, returning from...
Well, the funny thing was that I hadn't grown a beard, I'd grown, my hair was really long, extremely long. As you can see in some of those photos. But we arrived on Van Riebeck's day, the 6th of April. All the shops and everything was closed. I couldn't go and have a haircut, but it was interesting because I had 6 penguins, rockhoppers, that I somehow had to look after. So we had them in a box on the ship, and we arrived on the morning of April the 6th. I had to now get these penguins to the airport to fly to Durban. They were going to the aquarium. And now I had this long hair. I said to a couple of the crew members, I said, now are you staying on the ship? Yes, they're staying on the ship. So I said, now will you water and feed these penguins? Yeah, no, they'll do it. They said, okay, I must now go and organize a truck or something to load the penguins onto and to take them to the airport. Somehow, I can't remember how it is, I got a bucky and we could put the box of these 6 rockhopper penguins, which was, you know, it was about a meter by a meter, it wasn't big. But these guys, the crew, hadn't done what they said, they hadn't fed them or watered them. So when I came back some hours later, these penguins were very dehydrated, and I had to get a bottle of water and then take sips and spit it, you know, sort of penguin's mouth, you know, because they wouldn't take it. Anyway, so I got them hydrated a bit, loaded up the box. Don't know how I got the box off the ship. Maybe the driver helped me. And then I went out to the airport. And I arrived at the airport, and of course I was immediately a curiosity, because people didn't wear long hair like this, you see. And I was probably not kind of dressed as though I was a sort of a traveler. And I had to go and speak to the Airways check-in counter, and I said, look, I need to send penguins to Durban. And they thought this was, you know, they just thought I was bullshitting. But there's 6 penguins, and they're in a crate, and they need to go to Durban. So eventually they understood, and they had to go on a special flight that was pressurized, because they're the small sort of planes that went sort of Cape Town, George, Port Elizabeth, Durban were not properly pressurized in the hold. The cabins were, but not the hold. Anyway, eventually I got up to Durban and they survived. But then my folks had come down to pick me up, and they were staying in a fancy hotel. And I remember, you know, going down to breakfast and everybody looking at me and, you know, kind of thinking this is a real bloody beatnik sort of, you know, was when the deep were kind of, you know, kind of regarded as real unwashed mess. Anyway, so I was going, and then on the 7th I went into Adderley Street to look for a haircut. I got my mother, and I was walking down the street, and these little kids of about 5-year-olds walked up towards me, and they said, Ma, this is Jesus. Then I went into this barber shop, and the guy looked at me really kind of, you know, gave me a real dirty look, but couldn't turn me away, and you know, I sat down and I said, he thought I was one of those other people, you know. So I said, no, I'm chatty. But to begin with, he was really pissed off that I was going into his barbershop. But yeah, and then I think I just went back to Durban for a week's break or something, and then went to start writing up. Yeah.
Why didn't you hand in the dissertation of the masters at Bloemfontein?
Man, I quite frankly, I didn't think the Free State wasn't a highly respected university. I wasn't sure where I was going to. Well, because my original plan was to go back to University of Natal, and then I could get a bursary to do my honours in Pretoria. So I went to Pretoria, and then during my honours year, I registered. You see, I had to get honours before I could hand in a thesis. So it was more out of, it was more practical reasons. Yeah, yeah.
Then did you then stay involved with the islands?
No, because,
did you
well,
just go to Angola and stay?
No, then I went up to the Northern Transvaal to some game reserves up there for 2 years. Oh, well, I did the honours, yeah, handed my masters, and you know, this was all happening in parallel, and then I went up to the Northern Transvaal, and then when I was up in the Northern Transvaal in 1970, I got an offer of a job in Angola. So we went in 1971 and stayed there till 75.
1971 till 75.
Yeah.
And when did you become involved with the islands again?
And then when I came back, I was with CSIR. When did I go back first? Yeah, in 69. Yeah, I made a short two-day visit to Marion. I wanted to go and do some measurements of this Azarella, the cushions, you know. And I went down trip on a very quick, it must have been a relief, but I can't imagine why it was so short. Maybe I only had 2 days on the island because...
Was it on the RSA?
No, I think it was probably on the RSA. But then when I went down again in 87, I think we went on one of the Navy ships or some other ship. I can't remember. It wasn't the RSA and it wasn't the GUS.
But how did you come involved then with the EIA?
Because I was, you know, they needed the botanist, and I'd done EIA work elsewhere, you know, in Namibia and in Mozambique, and I don't know, you know, they could have asked Feldon Smith or somebody like that, but I was appointed, and it was just, you know, a short-term thing.
But did they approach you, or did you apply?
I can't remember. I think CSIR was asked to coordinate an EIA, and old Hamon, whatever his name was, first name, Hamon, who was a vice president of the CSIR. I think he was a physicist. He was asked to chair the group, and then we had a chap, Liebenberg, who was an engineer, private engineer from Liebenberg and Steiner, a very nice gentleman. And we had old, I can't remember the team, you've got a copy of the EIA. He's got old Erasmus, what's his name, Erasmus, from, he was at University of Port Elizabeth, zoologist, and myself, and they had an airport engineer and an aircraft, sort of, you know, they had sort of technical staff, and Pat Condy, who was the zoologist, he was one of the guys that worked on seals.
Yes, yeah. But the CSIR was approached by, I suppose,
government
directly,
yeah.
By the Department of
Transport or Environment Affairs, it would be Environment Affairs because of Bill Fisahi, who was the DG of Environment Affairs, either the DG at that time or Deputy DG at that time, he became DG, he came down as well. He must be in Pretoria, I'm not sure where, he's probably down at Strees Bay or one of these nice coastal places, yeah, Bill Fisahi.
Probably be William
Fisahi. I think he was originally from Zambia, you know, Afrikaans family, but I think they had been in Zambia or Zambia. He, you know, he'd grown up or at least spent some of his time outside of South Africa.
So you were asked to do this EIA. What information did they give you beforehand?
Well, really just the terms of reference, which was fairly detailed, but not a great deal, no. I think old Hamon, you must try and track him down. He was about probably 10 years older than me. I suspect he knew what was going on. There was never any discussion of any military sort of significance. It was all, and what I found improbable was that it was to be able to rescue, you know, any team member that was injured or not well. And, you know, you just do it's different now, but, I mean, the costs of building a 707 air runway, they could send the RSA down, they could just have the RSA hanging out there, you know. The cost of building a kilometer and a half runway in the sub-Antarctic. And that's you know, the economics of it just didn't make any sense at all.
But so what were you told what to, why did they ask for an EIA in the first place? And what
because,
were you told what to do?
Well, because it was already been proclaimed as a nature reserve or had any protected area status or not, the feeling was that, okay, Environment Affairs have got these, they might have had EIA legislation by that time, but basically it was the case, look, this is a sensitive environment. And the Antarctic, I mean, it was in terms of obligations under SCAR, I think it was probably some, you know, there was quite a lot of conservation policy by that time. So it was really in terms, I guess, I mean, the simple thing would be that government did not want to get embarrassed by an international outcry at the building of an airport in a sensitive sub-Antarctic place. And so they said, okay, let's do it the right way. And I think that they were also concerned about, you know, the economics and the safety of it. Because we had a sort of an airport safety officer in the team, and he was about the first to say, look, this is too dangerous a spot to, you know, land a big plane, because the runway is not going to be safe. Winds, the you know, the gales and everything, it takes 2 or 3 hours to get there. You get there and there's this sort of turbulent, you know. I think the EIA environmental component was probably a very minor consideration. What was the consideration was the safety and the economic feasibility, you know, the financial cost. And then probably third on the list is the fire important and sensitive. But they never, you'll see in the report, there was the press statement that, you know, eventually was released, sort of saying, well, the recommendation is not to go ahead with the project.
But were you under any pressure from the government leaning towards a certain finding?
No, I didn't ever feel that, you know, and one might have thought, but there wasn't. I mean, the team that we had there, we had regular sort of discussions around what we were finding, how we were going, and there was never anybody on the team that was sort of trying to push the discussion in one way or another.
But was there rumours in the back of your minds or so on that this might be for military purposes?
I think there might have been some sort of speculation or discussion on it, but it wasn't as though it was anything that was foremost in our thinking. You know, it was.
Okay. In terms of the work, I mean, what did you physically go do?
I did a vegetation map of the area that was, you know, the whole area involved, the affected area, and the sort of sensitivity analysis of what either specialized vegetation types or bird eating areas or any particular special environmental facet of it that we should be concerned about, and where, if there was going to be a road, would have had to have been built from Transvaal Cove to the site, which was down on Stony Ridge or Kerguelen Rise. I think it was, we looked at Long Ridge and then Stony Ridge and Kerguelen Rise, and I think Stony Ridge was the chosen site. But then we had to kind of suggest a suitable route for a road, because they'd have to be transporting thousands of tons of cement and steel and, you know, everything else to get there.
Sounds like a bit of a doom project from the start, if it's in hindsight.
Yeah.
Who were the major players pushing for a runway? Can you remember any individual?
No, but there is a book. There's a book. Have you seen that book on the South Africa's nuclear program? I just remember seeing it at exclusive books in the last 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
And there was a chapter, I think, at least a chapter dealing with this, the missile testing range and the whole kind of politics. But it wasn't visible. I was too much of a junior player.
It wasn't visible in terms of who actually went to go do the work.
No.
You didn't have sort of just visits from the intelligence service or anything in that regard.
It wasn't long. It was probably a week, 10 days. I can't remember. It wasn't, it was very tight. But we had a helicopter. We could take, those aerial photographs of the area, so I could map from reasonable aerial photographs, which they actually printed and produced right there on site. It was good.
Can you remember that our father was public attention given to this matter? Press or people asking you about it?
Not a great deal. I can't remember. Yeah, it was fairly, I wouldn't say hush-hush, but it wasn't sort of, you'd need to go to the newspapers around the time of the press release. And in the report, you'll get the date on which the press release went out. But, it wasn't like it was a high.
But there wasn't, what I want to know is there was wasn't any public knowledge about all the EI was done.
There's
going to be an EI.
I don't know. I think it was paid very kind of my impression. I guess so. I just don't.
Remember, was in charge of the
EI. Haymon. Yeah. H-E-Y-M-A-N-N. What is it? Gerard Haymon?
I know some Haymons. It's not that common.
No, it was a rudder one.
So during that week, did you guys live on the base?
In the base, yeah.
On the base. Did you at all consult with the team members there on whether they would like an airport?
I don't know. We probably might have, but I don't
know. People actually ever went at a useful edition?
I didn't, you know, I mean, having been there for 10 months, I didn't sort of have any passionate sort of feeling that was needed or anything. You know?
Look for differences, but did you notice a difference then between when you were there in 1986 versus when you were there in 1990?
Other than the invasive species, some of the plants had spread quite a lot. Yeah, one or two of the species, particularly Sagina, S-H-E-I-N-A. Sagina had spread a lot. But otherwise, I don't remember feeling there was, you know, that much change. But I mean, these things happened very gradually.
But would you think there's more of a change between 1986 and...
I guess so, yeah. But, you know, it's always...
It's a difficult stage because obviously now we're very
attuned to changes. There's so many factors involved. But I took photographs. I was measuring growth, and that's really the question. In fact, some of the photos, I must give them to... they're still in there. They haven't been planted yet. But some of the photos of before and after were marked as a revision. But, I mean, those were just natural processes. They weren't...
When you were on the island in 1986, nobody mentioned anything about covert Israeli operations or visits from Russian ships or anything that extent.
No.
Were you, I mean, back then I was 1 year old, so...
Yeah.
Was there any awareness in South Africa in general that South Africa had nuclear capabilities?
Well, I think that we knew there was a lot of nuclear research going on. It was because, I mean, where I used to have... In 1967 in Pretoria, I was staying in Magella... Well, I wasn't. I was staying in Park Street, and I used to go to the Magella hotels, Pullman Street, I think, for meals, for dinners. Mm. And my table mates, you know, who were also University of Natal, they were all working at Helen Garber on very hush-hush work research. So that's now 1966. Now, whether that was just, you know, just general nuclear research, or whether they were working on, you know, something that could develop further, I don't know. But that was 20 years before the time, you know.
Can you remember back in 1964, now that you're speaking about hush-hush, did you have to sign any contract that limited pictures or memoirs or diaries that you may publish or may not publish?
No. In terms of the science program, we wouldn't go rushing off and publishing before Bonson and Bucker, they brought everything together in a book. And that irritated me because I would have preferred to publish in international journals.
Yes.
But I mean... So
there was nothing in terms of private photos or...
Nothing was the same strengths.
When you went down now in 2010?
No.
How did the media...
Well, I think what... we signed these things about conservation and...
Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay, do you know how the media... Why they knew how to interview you?
No.
Yeah, was it...
It might have been. It might have been Anne... or they might have spoken to Henny Smith, I think. At the last moment, you know, Henny said, Brian, they want to interview you about this thing. You know, what's the... Yeah.
Okay, in terms of your trip in 2010, I don't think you expected you would see the island again. Mm-hmm.
Well, I always, I had, you know, several years ago, I had asked to go down on a relief of DEA.
Mm.
And they said, but they didn't. I mean, DEA is so bloody useless. So Bam Yaka was then DG. Then I wrote to old Augustine. Is Augustine? What's his name?
Valentine.
About 3 years ago to say, never really got a response. And I spoke to UDG a couple of years ago. And she said, but then. They never really did anything. And then I spoke to Steve, and Steve said, look, you know, there's likely to be a gap at some stage. And basically I was waiting until I retired, because when I was CEO of Sandby, I couldn't get... So I wasn't in a hurry, but I was always sort of keen to go down. And so, you know, do you don't see what changes, what is happening there? And, I just like going up to Angola regularly. I'm enjoying it.
So it was sort of what if the opportunity arose, you knew you would say yes, and you would go looking for the opportunity.
Yeah, that's right.
And when you saw Marin Island again, was there any kind of feeling, sort of emotion you would attach to the island?
Not really. I'm not a sort of kind of somebody who gets kind of worked up about these things. When I left Angola in a convoy of 10,000 refugees, not expecting to have to leave the country, when I said it took 3 weeks to get to the border, difficult conditions, I thought, oh, when I get to the border, I'll be very emotional. Took a job in Victoria the next day, 2 or 3 days later. I mean, I'm not kind of, but I mean, it was just fantastic to be back. Yeah, I know, it's wonderful to be back, but it's not as though like a homecoming, something like that. I was pleased to find it was, you know, being well looked after, essentially.
Okay, so the time you went back down, there's one essential 1986 and the time you went down in 2010. So they were back a lot.
Yeah.
Did that make any change in the atmosphere of the island, would you say?
I think it was good. It was nice to find that, yeah. You know, in 65, there was always this, well, even until probably 85, you know, women wouldn't be allowed to go down to these roads. And I was very impressed with the energy and commitment of all the team that's there now. Going off doing field work, not sort of, complaining about having to climb these bloody mountains and the rain and whatnot. You know, there was sort of the stereotype women that, you know, on her, you can't. And I even found when I was down there, you know, like Anne came back from going down to Algarve, there was a big pack on her back, and I thought, yeah, you know, it's tough for a girl to carry a pack like that. And it wasn't that she was waiting around for somebody to go with her and help her. She went off by herself. And the other, you know, all the women there are, you can see they're doing their job just as a man do it, and the same as the young black workers, researchers there. And I think it makes for a much more comfortable sort of setup. I thought it was good. They all got on well together. I mean, what one sees, of course, you know, there's no more reason for there to be stress between men and men if there's some tension about something.
And back in 1964, when you went on, did you ever discuss the ability that women might not going, or that you miss women,
Oh, you'd all discuss about missing. It was never kind
of, even a question or a debate.
Yeah, it wasn't the thing. No, it was, you know, the paradigm then was come down to this stuff.
Black people wouldn't even feature.
So it wasn't.
But it's not something you would say you particularly noticed that's different about the island.
Well, I did notice it very much so that these young women were doing work, tremendous work all over the place. They just get on, so if they're not looking around waiting for some man to come and carry the bags.
Be gentlemanly.
It was impressive.
The new base?
Well, I think it's a bit of an overkill, and as with all things, architects don't listen to the client. I got very angry when we left Marriott in 65, 66. I wrote a memo sort of saying that one's got to do something about the drying room, our drying room for all our clothes. And it was about the size of a toilet, you know, so average size bathroom, and we had paraffin heaters.
Oh.
And these paraffin heaters would flare up, and it was just waiting for how it happened, and that's what happened. The place burned down. But they didn't take any notice of, you know, our comments. And I would have thought if that architect had spoken to people about base, the idea of having it as a hermetically sealed unit so you can't get, you know, any fresh air from outside, they should have known they could just have little, even if it's little fan lights or something that you can open so you can get fresh air in, and have it divided to sort of a unit that could be for the big session and then for the normal US session. But now they've got to keep the whole base operating essentially for the sake of, you know, a dozen or two dozen people.
Yeah, and they're not just all those utilities.
Yeah, big statement.
It is essentially
all kinds. Yeah, sure.
Okay, would you say that your years spent essentially as a scientist, you guys weren't team members, you were there for a reason or expedition. But nevertheless, would you say that you changed some way you approach?
I don't know, I've always been fairly independent, and it certainly, you know, I suppose was good for my career, and just for personal reasons, it was fantastic to do that. But yeah, I don't change anything about my thinking or belief system or anything like that. You know, just an experience was fantastic and it was good.
What would you say is most valuable?
Focused on getting jobs done and just being able to work independently and getting self-confidence and independence. But I could have, I mean, when you look now at the available literature and the sort of intellectual resources that are available and technological resources, I could have done 10 times as much in that period. But on the other hand, it would have been not as much sort of adventure, really, because, you know, stuff was all there. So.
Yeah, just one last thing. Interesting. What was Obos like?
He was okay.
he was a friendly
He was a friendly, lazy...
Jealous dog.
a friendly, lazy, fattish dog.
What did you feed him?
Everything. Whatever. But he was a bit overfed with, you know, meatballs and, bully beef, fat eggs and bacon and, you know, whatever. And chocolates. And, yeah, he used to eat a slab of a chocolate at the time. He was spoiled.
Did you get to meet Betsy the bird or Prime Minister
I met Willem and his wife at some point in Victoria, but only briefly, you know. I haven't really had contact with them since then. We might have exchanged some correspondence early on.
Would you recommend that a young scientist in the natural sciences, or especially things like biology, spend a year on an island base like that? Does it mean any terms?
Today a young scientist should definitely have at least 2 weeks training in all the technological aids that you can use there before you get there. You know, GPS, satellite imagery, all these new little things for climate, microclimatic warning, all the instrumentation you're going to need. You need to be trained in that use before you go there. Now, maybe today it's sort of fairly normal to have that training in, you know, degree courses. But, I think it's a fantastic thing for anybody to go and spend a year on the island. But they mustn't get locked into it. It should not. I mean, it's great that some people are, like Valden and Steve and others, and Silga, also Martin. It's great that there's some people there that have continued all along. But I think it can be limiting if you just get locked into a career on island research. Because really, that's not where the future is for a scientist. You know, there's room for some specialists, and it's great that they're there. But, you know, for the average person, it's just like a good... I'm glad that I broke away from it. One of my regrets is that when I sent my MSc thesis to Big Guru on that sort of work at the time, who was at Billings at Duke University, he said, look, wouldn't you like to come and do a PhD at Duke? Now, Duke is one of the big... And I sort of thought... And that's one of the things I regret. If I had really thought through, I would have gone to Duke, got a PhD at Duke. But that would have led me in a purely academic career. That's not where my strength would have been. So
you also in policy.
Yeah, and institutional thing, you know. It would have been very good for my CV to have gone there. And it was a wonderful opportunity because he was like a guy at the time in Arctic, Alpine, tundra work. And it would have been good, but on the other hand, you know, but I think for any young scientist, male or female, spending a year on the island would be excellent. So a gap year type of thing.
So you think field work?
I think, my one worry would be is that one needs to get beyond just counting seals and, you know, and counting in whale seals. And you've got to have that monitoring. It's excellent to have that monitoring. But, Steve has brought in extremely sophisticated experimental science, which is very good for the art. You know, he's like a step ahead of the rest of the games, I can see. And that's excellent. But there's still some need for fairly basic natural history work there, which I think they, in terms of their science strategy, they might sort of think about that a bit. I've discussed this with Steve, and he agrees, but you know, it's a very difficult system to get into, you know, to get into the funding cycle.
That's what I wanted to say. Will there be funding for simple natural research?
Well, it's not so
counter global warming.
It's more sort of philosophical side of natural history. It's a Darwinian kind of perspective that I think one needs to put more into. You see, now it's become very technological and very statistical, but not, it's not sitting down and, it's not somebody sitting down there and thinking, how does this stuff work? And there are some scientists at UCT and other places that could bring a different sort of perspective to the research program. You know, it's not a serious issue.
In terms of tourism, how would you think about tourism?
I don't think it's going to work there because firstly, the other options are so much more attractive in South America. Going to the south of, Argentina, you can fly to the place. You can do the, you know, the Drake Passage, Kerguelen, what's it, the Magellan Passage, all of that. You can do all that stuff in a 5-day package, and then you fly home. For Marion, you've got to fly, you've got to get to Cape Town. You've got to take a 5-day boat trip.
And
it's not a tourist boat. Then you get there, and when you go, you've got to have a helicopter to take you ashore, and then you've got to walk maybe down to Tripod or to Ship's Cove, and then what next? You know, you can't, and the tourists that can afford to do that sort of tourism are not going to be able to, you know, kind of wander down to Tripod or up to Ship's Cove on a quick afternoon. And so the market is, I'm sure, too small, too limited. So they've got this facility that you would sleep, you know, 50 tourists or something. But tourists, in any case, would not sleep on the island. They won't sleep on the ship because they've got a 5-star accommodation on the ship and they've got the comfort of the air. Yeah, so I don't think it's a tourist destination, but I think naively it's a
home tourism. Would you have any ethical or conservation issue?
Not really, because I think Ship's Cove, Tripod, which are the two sort of tourist destinations, are really quite compromised in terms of when I counted with any the number of I must ask this, is that something I want to ask you? The wandering albatrosses between Tripod and the base counted 72 wandering albatross between. Now, I mean, I'm sure there's nothing like that number now. Human disturbance, you know. And I think that human disturbance would be quite a problem.